Faith Middleton, and this show is about the richness of life. We're going to talk about starting over, beginning again. Thanks for listening in Connecticut, Rhode Island, Massachusetts, and New York, including the East End of Long Island. Most of us know what it is to begin again. It could be returning to a cherished dream you thought you'd long forgotten, or working on something so long it felt like a permanent appendage until you realized this long project was over and you needed to begin again on something else. Amy Bloom, author of the new novel Lucky Us, joins us shortly. My partner in this exploration, lucky me, is our show's longtime contributor, Bruce Clements. Bruce, I remember Michael Jordan, the best professional basketball player of all time, in my opinion. He walked away from his stunning career when his father was murdered. Do you remember this? And he decided to try to become a professional baseball player. And I think to myself, at the time even, I thought, he's so heartbroken. He just wants to get away from everything that's familiar, I think. But I thought, what did that, looking back on it, what must that have felt like to him, being number one all over the world and maybe in history, and then starting from scratch?
Absolutely right. And starting from scratch, surrounded by curiosity and high expectations.
Yeah, he didn't make it, and eventually went back to basketball.
Oh, I didn't remember that either. I'd forgotten that he returned to his old stand.
Yeah, Bruce, you're at work on a new young adult novel right now.
Yes,
and you've written so many of them. So let's talk for a couple of minutes. We're going to get to Amy Bloom in just a second to get at this. But so what do you feel like every time you're starting over with a new novel?
I feel as if I had never done it before. Hannah tells me that I always try to do it in a different way and to have a different set of expectations of myself, either in terms of the sort of research I'm doing, or the voice of the novel, or the setting, to be coming at it in a different way. I'm not aware of that, but I think she probably knows.
That's interesting. All right, let's go to Amy Bloom, who lives in Connecticut, is getting ready for a reading from her newest novel, Lucky Us, at the Stony Creek Library this Friday night. Amy, welcome back.
Thank you. Nice to be back. Nice to be home.
Yeah. So you've been traveling around the world talking about Lucky Us on tour, and I would imagine you're trying to begin a new book. So what's it like for you to begin again?
Well, I spent all day today actually in my office taking out my research files for Lucky Us and saving the few files that I thought could apply to the next novel, which takes place in the 1930s, and Lucky Us took place in the 1940s. So lucky for me, there is a little bit of overlap, and putting out my new research books, most of which I've already read, and banishing all traces of Lucky Us. So the housekeeping was sort of the first part for my mental health, and the other part is, as Bruce says, I mean, of course, it's as if you've never done it before, even though you know what your habits are. I mean, even though you have the same yellow-lined pad of paper and a bunch of pens, it's always new. And, of course, one doesn't want to write the same book again. You need a new voice. You need a new journey. You need a new story and a new core, because otherwise you're just writing the same novel over and over again. And I think that, although sometimes successful for some writers, would be, for me, really dispiriting.
And is there something that either of you keep around you that you would say, not that either of you need it, but is confidence boosting?
Well, I think the yellow pad is confidence boosting.
Well, it suggests that you will have something to put on it someday.
Yes,
so that's
right.
The great thing about the yellow pad. I personally like a cup of coffee.
I'm asking that question because I know some authors who will keep books that they've done that they especially felt good about and just glance over at them every once in a while or look around at other novels on the shelves and say, just to remind themselves, I'm part of this big conversation out there.
Amy, what about the tool? What about devoted yourself to a kind of pencil or a kind of writing deal?
I like, I like the Uniball pen. I like my yellow pad. I have composition books, notebooks, you know, like you had in elementary school scattered around. I like a couch to lie down on. So those tools I really like. And in terms of the keeping the book around, I think it works both ways. I don't know how it is for you, Bruce, but for me, on a certain day, it can be very reassuring. Like, oh, I did write those sentences. Apparently, I am not an idiot. You know, that's very reassuring. But on a really bad day, you look at the sentences, or at least I do, and I think, who wrote that? How did she do that?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
It's just like looking at photographs of yourself when you are, 22. On a certain day, you go, yeah, I was just gorgeous. And then on another day, you go, oh, that's so long ago.
Uh-huh, uh-huh.
So I find myself, Amy, I find myself appalled on roughly every third day that I could have been so dumb the day before, and what I did the day before could be so self-conscious, silly, shallow, and embarrassing.
So,
yeah, well, that's true, and you don't want to keep track of those days. You know, the utterly misguided and tone deaf. And you just plod on. I mean, I always like the idea that people in the audience will sometimes ask questions, strongly implying that you must wake up every day and do a pretty good job of it.
Amy,
which is very nice,
Amy,
although not true.
When you were working as a professional therapist and you saw clients who'd been through, I don't know what, you know, either death or divorce or some kind of breakup of something important, and the people said the words to you, I will just never have this again, or I will never be happy again, or whatever it might be, is it possible to say to a person, yes, you will, and be believed?
Oh, I don't know. I certainly, did my best when people were in terrible grief to be with them in their terrible grief, but I don't remember assuring anybody that it was going to pass anytime soon or that happiness would be available to them, because I'm not sure that's the kind of thing you can persuade anybody of.
Mm-hmm.
I suggest that it was worth sticking around to find out.
Guy who used to talk to students, some of whom go through terrible things, and at one time a pastor, I don't think I have ever said that, because I, for one thing, I'm not absolutely sure that it's the truth, but also it just seems shallow and not likely to be believed.
Uh-huh. Right. I mean, as I say, my goal was always just to make sure that people were willing to stick around for a while so they could find out. But I'm also aware that deep loss takes a long time. And I think for writers, we are much more amenable to being encouraged. I'm happy when somebody encourages me, especially if it's somebody who knows what they're talking about. I may dismiss their remarks, but I appreciate the fact that they think I can do it. I certainly wouldn't want somebody who went, you're right, probably won't ever really work out for you again. I don't want to hear that.
But I also don't want to hear the assumption on the part of the person in front of me, well, of course, you writers, you have talent. It must be marvelous. It's to have this inspiration. And you, of course, like any other worker, are aware that a brick wall is a long job and involves getting your hands abraded.
It does. There's also the sense of no matter how great the award, you must get up the next morning and put your pants on one leg at a time and begin the whole process over again. I think that's what we're getting at. I know, Amy, that you must have felt that after being nominated for the National Book Award. You have to get up and write something else.
Right. And then again, you know, it's a lot like breathing. And it's a lot like work. It's an incredibly privileged kind of work, but nevertheless, it does require effort and time and discipline and, you know, a wish to do it and a knack for storytelling is not going to get you there.
Oh, thank you so much. Amy Bloom, author of Lucky Us, her most recent novel, very well received, and speaking at the Stony Creek Library this Friday night. Thanks so much for spending a little time. And welcome back. Welcome back. Bruce Clements, stay right where you are. We're going to take a quick break. And on the other side of this, we have Helen Hook of the Landmark Women's Rock Band that was a sensation in the 70s, Deadly Nightshade. She and her bandmates have begun again many times, but in a big way the last time. There's even a name for it, the Comeback Album. Stay with us. I'm Faith Middleton with Bruce Clements, exploring what it is in life to begin again, to rediscover an old dream, to survive a loss, to come back from a war, to move from college to the professional world, or try to. Call and tell us how you started fresh or began again when we open the phones in just a little bit. Bruce, right now I want to introduce you to Helen Hook, who is a member of women's band, the Deadly Nightshade. And I say women's rock band because back in the 70s when they were performing, this was a very big deal to have a women's rock band going around the country. It was a big, big hit, this band, the Deadly Nightshade. And I have in my hands a CD called Never, Never Gonna Stop. And we're going to talk, I want you to hear a little bit of this. This was recorded 30 years after the band began. They have reunited and done this CD, The Deadly Nightshade, Never, Never Gonna Stop. Let's listen to this. Oh, I had fun listening to this roaring through the countryside. The Deadly Nightshade, Never, Never Gonna Stop. And we have Helen Hook from that band, Bruce. Helen, welcome to the show.
Hi, Faith. It's so nice to be on the show. And hello, Bruce.
And congratulations to you and your bandmates. So what was it like, what was the challenge of taking this up again after 30 years and doing a CD, why did you want to do it? And, you know, what was the great challenge of it?
Well, we actually just sort of got together on a lark to just try and see if we could do a concert, the three of us. And we had no idea what to expect, really. But we got together and we just started playing and we started singing and we just stopped. And it was like, oh my God, we still sound the same. So we did a couple of concerts and we actually went back to the Northampton area because that's where we all went to school and that's where we had a big following. That's kind of our home base 30 years ago. And, you know, we
did a concert at the Institute of Musical Arts, and we had no idea whether or not anybody would come because we didn't know if anyone would remember us. And the place was absolutely packed. People came out of the woodwork. It was, like, so fun. So it was kind of like back to the same old, and, you know, people just kind of liked that kind of ribald sense of humor thing that we had, and the fiddle and Anne and her washboard and all the funny instruments that she played. And so, you know, it just kind of started over again. So we said, hey, maybe we should do a CD.
Yeah, now let's pause right there. Why?
Well, you know, as musicians, you know, you can do live performance, but it's kind of lost. And the thing that we felt that we were, you know, the thing that was important to us, we did a lot of original music. So when you do a CD, it's like your music. It's like Bruce or Amy writing a book. It's kind of like you putting down on paper your creation. That's how you do it as a musician. So.
And did it? How much courage did it take for all of you to begin again?
Well, we just did it for fun at the beginning, but it took more than courage because Pamela lives in Miami and Anne lives in Arizona, so I can't, you know, we're like, really, it's really a challenge for us to get together and do gigs and, you know, do the recordings and stuff like that, but. You know, we were very lucky because we had Roma Baron, who is a friend of mine, just happens to be a friend of mine, but she's a fantastic, fantastic record producer that did a lot of Laurie Anderson records. And so
I was just going to say, I'm not sure they come any better.
Yeah, so, you know, the fact that we had Roma working with us, you know, and I had always wanted to work with Roma, so, you know, we had some confidence about the way it would come out.
Bruce?
Is there any difference if I were to play record one and then the new one, would I hear a difference if I were well educated in such things?
I think you would, Bruce, because, well, our first record was produced by Felix Cavallari of the Rascals, who is like such an icon in the music industry. He's so amazing. And it was very, very polished. And we had a lot of instruments that were not part of our band. Like, we had an entire, like, jazz band arranged by Howard Johnson, the tuba player, and the Brecker Brothers. And we had all these, like, sidemen that were just, like, the best, best musicians. So there was, like, strings on a couple of the tunes. And, you know, it was like, this is just us, this record. This is, we played everything on this record. Except for Vivian Stoll played some drums, because you've got to have, like, the rhythm thing.
So is there another one in you?
Another record?
Mm-hmm.
You never know. You never know. I mean, you know, I do my own music, and I just don't stop. I never stopped for the 30 years. I just kept doing my own records. But the Deadly Nightshade is getting back together next summer. And we're going to be playing around New England and New York area. And, you know, I love writing. I just love writing because it's a way of expressing yourself in your unique way. And I think The Deadly Nightshade is kind of, well, we talk to women's issues, and yet we do it with this sense of humor. So.
Yeah, you do. Thank you so much for being on the show, Helen, and congratulations to you and your bandmates.
Thanks so much, Faith.
All right, Helen Hook of The Deadly Nightshade, the new CD after 30 years is Never, Never Gonna Stop. I have a feeling they have a couple more of these in them. I'm with Bruce Clements, and we're talking about beginning again. Bruce, it strikes me that children in particular are so skilled at this. And I think about the courage it takes for a child. Everything is new that they experience. Go ahead.
Yeah, well, I've been thinking about children as well. And the new you bring back to school in September, the sense when you leave school of a sort of endless summer in front of you, and then when you return, you're somewhat different. You may not be that aware of it. Some of the people around you are different, and you have again to reestablish your place in that. sure for most of it, most of us, it came fairly easily, but not by no means for all of us. And, you know, to build again who you were 11 weeks ago, that's pretty daunting.
Mm-hmm. I know these twins who had to go to a school where they were finally, you know, just had gotten old enough so that they were separated into different classes. And it was, you know, there were two kids who had to begin again with not only with new friends and a new atmosphere and new expectations, but especially as they had to begin as individuals now because they weren't tied to each other's waists. And yeah. It was a thing.
Your other half.
Yeah, it was really a thing.
Yeah,
Bruce,
yeah.
I'm close to a child who had decided at age, let me think, at age 13 that she is a he and has, you know, begun to go through the process of the transgender life and is now a he and has had, you know, every day. From what I'm seeing, what I'm gathering, what I'm hearing, is a new experience for this child. Amazing.
Well, that is really so interesting. I was thinking of the same thing and of the fact that we all know that, and certainly age has nothing to do with it. You realize from time to time that you're the same person you were years ago, sometimes, you know, appalled by that fact. You know, things that you thought you had outlived, vices that you thought you had put behind you, and attitudes that you thought you had somehow outgrown, and a crisis or meeting someone again or a new experience. You suddenly find yourself, my God, I'm still the same. I'm still the same guy. And I wonder, that must be to some degree the experience of someone even when she or he is very young and undergoing something so complex and so in some sense so public.
Yes, I was thinking about what happens when a child is born. The first words said are, it's a girl or it's a boy. And that's not always the correct label, it turns out, in terms of how that child experiences the self and the world. And so here is a child who says, I'm actually not a girl, I am a boy. And the doctors all agree. And so now, you know, what must that be like? You know, what is a boy?
Yeah.
You know, what? Who was I before? Now, who am I? Am I different? I mean, just incredible to watch this.
It would be. I've never spoken to such a person. I would love to open myself to at least some of what they went through, because that is, it's more, in some sense, more than a religious transformation, though it, I dare say, has some of the quality of religious conversion.
So, Bruce, you reminded me, since Bruce Clements is with me, we're exploring about what it is in life to begin again. You know, maybe it's rediscovering an old dream, surviving a loss, to come back from a war. I was saying it might be that you were in college and you're going into the professional world, so to speak. Or you're in trade school, whatever it might be, just that sense of I am beginning again. This is a, you know, an important transition of some kind. And what's that about? What does it require? Does it sometimes just feel so natural and other times so challenging? That's what we're getting at. So I was sitting with Bruce last night talking about this and thinking, and you know what flew into my head? That there used to be soap operas, and I was talking to a soap opera star about this, where the writers, you know, there would be a character who'd been with the show for 5 years. And so all the fans of the show, they know every single thing. You know, there's soap opera going on every day. The guy dies, let's say, and then, you know, comes back in the next season again without a word of explanation. He's just the same. He's just the same character back again. No explanation. No, he really didn't die or anything. No obligation to explain.
I'm surprised by that.
The character comes back. This man or woman and is, you know, after dying in one show is now a brain surgeon in the next show. I mean, hilarious.
Imagine the disappointment of someone who has been watching this character for 4 years and has rejoiced that at long last Alfred is dead, and then Alfred comes back. I would be outraged. I thought you had killed him off and taken him out of my life, and now look at him again.
Yeah, talk about. I thought, what was the writer's sense of obligation to the viewers?
Yes.
You know, obviously none really. It just was a matter of, well, what's the best way to handle this drama? You know, no obligation. And you didn't see people picketing on the street, or there wasn't any online thing back in the day. You know, people would just, I guess, take it and go forward.
I'm amazed.
Yeah. So this brings us to this topic of grief and the sense of beginning again. And of course, it could be the loss of a relationship. That's one of those things we think of all the time. But it certainly is also the death of someone that you deeply care about. And this idea of thinking what you feel about that will never end. You will never be the same.
Well, and I would see a different aspect of it from my experience, and that is the terror that they have taken away something you will never get back, a vocation, certainly a duty. That everybody, you know, who has served someone who is dying knows that a duty has been taken away and a burden and a joy have been taken away. But sometimes, and that's my experience anyway, I was terrified that something had died and been carried away by this person.
A person in your life?
Yeah.
And was it your role with that person, or was it?
No, it was deeper than that. It was just, there's a kind of common expression for that. You know, it's like losing your right arm, and I think that that's a very good metaphor. You know, part of yourself has somehow been carried away, and maybe part of yourself you didn't realize you had until that has happened. But sometimes just, you know, a skill, a sympathy, a readiness that suddenly isn't there right now and may never come back.
Mm-hmm. I was thinking of a good friend of mine who died, and when she died, and it was very shocking, I would say about 10 years ago, it dawned on me for the first time that though I had been the recipient of her love so often, this kind of generous, open-hearted person, it never stopped to take stock of that. And so I realized when she died that I would never have that experience again, and that I could never do it over again. I could never tell her how much I appreciated how supportive she was, how generous, how just generally loving and interested. The unconditional love that she gave to me and I saw at her funeral so many other people. It was so hard not to be able to tell her, I saw it, and thank you.
Well, on the other hand, you sometimes are aware that someone has given you something. You know, as, perhaps it is a mentor who has suddenly left. You know, a senior teacher who has carried you for a few years and supported you for a few years, and then gets a job somewhere else, and there you are suddenly in the school again, having to be a teacher on your own. I'm talking obviously from personal experience, on your own, and then discovering that what that person gave you, you still have. They didn't take it away, and you are somehow you somehow grow a little bit in strength, moving into the space that person occupied for you, so that their absence has become another reason and another opportunity for growth.
Bruce Clements is with me. We invite you now. We're going to open the phones, take a short break. We're going to open the phones for you to tell us how you began again, started over, started fresh, went back to something after a long time, a dream, a project, to begin again. 203-776-9677, 203-776-WNPR, and Bruce Clements and I will return in just a couple of minutes. I'm Faith Middleton, and it is great to have you listening on the show. I want to say thanks to Marion Roy and our producers, Lori Beck and Jonathan McNichol. Also wanted to let you know that next Monday on the show, we are going to air something we call Up Close and Personal, personal, really fun questions with Dan Malloy and Tom Foley, because certainly with all these attack ads out there, their concentration on slinging mud at each other and, attacking in general, the aggression of this ad campaign is so intense. We thought it'd be good for you to hear who these people are as people. So that's next Monday at 3 and 9 p.m. here on the Faith Middleton Show. Okay, Bruce, we have Janice on the line. Welcome to the show, Janice. Hi.
Hello? Hi,
Janice. Go ahead.
Hi. I was just really struck by the last thing that was said about the old teacher kind of occupying the space that the new teacher went into, and I just thought about my daughter and her transition that she's about to go into. She's an eighth grader in middle school, and she'll be going into high school, and we're kind of contemplating whether or not she'll stay with me or live with her father elsewhere and go to high school in his area. And, you know, you're always kind of wondering whether or not you're ready, she's ready, the family is ready. And that just kind of, that was like a light bulb moment for me where I feel like maybe now she's ready to move into that space that I am occupying for her. And that is another level of growth for her.
Huh, Janice.
Oh, yes, yes. And what a judgment to have to make as to whether she is in fact up to that now or not.
Yes, yes. And I think she is. I think she is. I think sometimes it's harder for parents, you know, than it is for kids. But man, what an aha moment for me.
Wow.
to say, you know, that I am occupying a space that is probably a space that she is ready to move into for her own growth. So I want to thank you guys for that.
Oh, you're so.
And which you have modeled for her.
Yes.
Thank you so much, Janice. That's a perfect example. Thank you so much.
Thanks.
All right, and good luck to you.
Thank you.
To your family. Bruce, do you remember the late Grace Paley's poem about beginning again? she has a whole book of poems called Begin Again. But there's one that's just a few lines, you know, begin again, it's easy. Do you remember that?
No. Yes, I do. Of course. And the whole poem is in some fundamental way about how hard it is.
Yeah, it's easy, and yes, and no, it's not. You know, I think about these college grads who have to go out into the world. There are sometimes no jobs for them. I know the job market is improving in Connecticut. It's improving elsewhere in the country, too. Some lucky people in some cities, things are booming. But that sense of going out into the world and trying your darndest to begin again and not being able to hook up with the kind of job that you have trained for,
yeah.
That's really something.
Yeah. And, you know, I think we really can't miss talking, at least briefly, about men and women who are coming back from Iraq and Afghanistan and elsewhere, and who look perhaps pretty much the same, a little older, whose habits may be very, very much things that you're familiar with, whose tastes in food and whose way of walking may not have changed at all, but who are simply no longer who they were when you knew them 18 months ago or 2 years ago or even more recently than that.
Yeah, I had that on my list too, Bruce. I was thinking how amazing that is to have the kind of intimacy that you have from that experience with other soldiers. So there's that, to be exposed to the kinds of things that they're exposed to, you know, sometimes indescribably traumatic to witness, the anxiety that can get created from that. And the transition that is expected of you when you come home, sometimes rarely on leave for a short time to begin again with your family, returning to your family, and then finally when you're discharged totally. I remember spending some time over at the VA in West Haven, Connecticut, and they actually created a ceremony. I think it was called the Drumming Out Ceremony. And they would welcome, you know, family and friends of the soldier who was a resident at the VA for a variety of reasons, would stand up in uniform, and another officer would stand there, and they would play the drums and a flag, and family members and members of the community would get up and they would say, please, we now officially hand to you this soldier who has given so much, and they would turn the soldier back to his own community as a symbolic and emotional gesture to say, this is a big transition for you. You've been through so much. We get it. And now you are in the care of your family and your community. Unbelievable.
Oh, gosh. What a smart thing. What an incredibly smart thing to offer. I'm sure it works very well sometimes and not well other times. But I wonder if there are like ceremonies that we have to return us to the place we cared for and that cared for us. I can't think of any at the moment.
Well, what it struck me about that ceremony, it would, you know, largely symbolic but so important, was the sense of returning after all those experiences that you can't describe and feeling somehow, even though you appear to fit in, to feel still outside, maybe even yourself, and certainly outside the structures that you knew.
Yeah.
And here was a way of saying, you know, we officially recognize there is a place for you. There is some place for you to fit in. Your family is taking you back, and you will grow and change. And we will all do this as a system together.
Yeah.
Wow.
And there must be implicit in that some word which says, and we know that your love and theirs is the same, but changes have happened. We know that. We acknowledge that. That's got to be part of it.
I hope so. I wish I remembered. This is some, you know, quite a long time ago. I wish I remembered the words because it was profound. So here's our number, speaking of words, 203-776-9677. Here on the Faith Middleton Show, I'm with Bruce Clements, who is a former chair of the Children's Law Center in Hartford, Connecticut. And so, Bruce, that reminds me of divorce. And I know that the Children's Law Center provides attorneys for children so that they're not just their rights, but their feelings will be represented in these high-stress custody situations. Talk about beginning again for these kids.
Well, there, I think it is discovering power more than, I don't know whether more than anything else, but the children I knew at the law center, part of our work there was to help them to see I am not a powerless person. And the attorney then stands by your side. And because the attorney has taken time with you and knows you and addresses you in an entirely new way. I mean, addresses you as someone with rights, who dresses you with someone for whom room must be made, addresses you as someone who has some power. These negotiations, these exchanges between attorney and child are just transforming, absolutely transforming. You know, I did a book about that. I did a novel about that called What Erica Wants, and what Erica, you know, the title was very deliberately chosen, that you have wants. We understand what they are. They are legitimate. You can take them on as part of yourself. It is for some of our young clients, absolutely transforming.
What do you think the role of choice is? I know it is probably antidote to depression, as Dr. Nancy Horn, the psychologist, would say. But I wonder what the role of choice is in beginning again, no matter what. You know, how much that choice has to do with your ability, this empowering thing you're talking about, your ability to try something for the first time, to go forward.
Especially since some of the situations into which we find ourselves are situations we did not create. We did not create this. I didn't want this divorce, or I didn't want to fall in love again. I had my independence. I want to keep it, and yet here I am, having to discover strength and to have a to make a life again.
Mm-hmm. So if you are an artist who knows what it's like to stare at an empty canvas after you have finished a painting, to begin again, to look at a canvas that you like or don't like and begin another one, to make a speech or to have said something to someone that you regret and then think, how do I take that back? How do I begin again with this person? I think about people who try to fly when they're fearful every single time and what that's like to begin the journey again. I think about Barbara Streisand, who it talks so much about the terror, the absolute terror that she feels performing in public, and yet somehow manages to begin that life again every single time. These are the kinds of things that Bruce and I are looking at. It's what we do every day, begin again.
What about falling in love again. I mean, if you have been hurt after truly giving as much of yourself as you could possibly give and discovering things about yourself that you didn't know you had to give and giving them, and then finding yourself, it's not too much to say, not too dramatic to say, betrayed, and then meeting someone else. You know, I've not had that experience, but I dare say it is very shaking.
Yes. I so agree. 203-776-9677. In your life right now, Bruce, how do you think you're beginning again?
I'm beginning again by trying not to let go of the things that define me. That is, I'm a guy of a certain age, and people around me are, I think, occasionally in fear, giving up roles they once had, or telling themselves, I no longer have to do that. I no longer have to seek new relationships. I no longer, you know, I've been there, done that. That sense. And for me, it's not the most important thing is remembering who I am and continuing to apply these expectations to myself. No, life doesn't owe me anything. No, it's not time to stop being compassionate, to stop feeling for other people, to stop reaching out. No. But that plays to me as reaching inside myself and trying to keep alive the impulses, the longings, the curiosities, the energy that I have experienced happily throughout my life.
You're saying it, when you're around for a certain amount of time, it sounds like it could very easily, you could very easily let your world get smaller.
Absolutely. And it is it's a siren song. It is very seductive to think you might let your world get smaller. In fact, a smaller world only invites more shrinkage. It's a very, very dangerous course to embark on, the course which says in effect, now I'm owed, I'm not a debtor anymore, others are debtors.
Bruce,
you know, in that sense, and I say that to myself, I think that you are a debtor and you always will be. Get out there and pay your debts as best you can.
No matter what your physical capacity.
No matter what your physical capacity. No. No matter what. The obligation doesn't recede. It doesn't become less. And the price of letting it recede is something of your humanity. You just cannot let that go. You cannot tolerate letting it go if you possibly can avoid it.
Huh. Thank you. That was worth everything, listening to that from you. Thank you so much. That's one of the wisest things I've heard in a long, long time, Bruce. Bruce Clements, as always, lucky me, huh? This show is about the richness of life, and you can find the books, people, great recipes, all the things we talk about right now online at foodschmooze.org or the Faith Middleton Show on WNPR.org. In New Haven, I'm Faith Middleton.